No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Marilia Duffels, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So feel free to join in and be part of the conversation at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype your questions into us, and we'd be happy to answer them. Anyway, tonight is a special night because we have my dear friend, Maria Sanchez, on the show tonight. And as you probably remember, if you listen to the show regularly, Maria was my co-host for 6 years. I can't believe it. She really took the show from infancy into a really great show. And she was such an important part of the progression of the show. We're so happy to have her back. And guess what? She's no longer Maria. She's now Dr. Sanchez. So rather than tell you all the wonderful things about this woman, like I usually introduce our guests, I'm going to let her tell us what she's been doing lately. Maria, thanks so much. Welcome back to the show. And before we get started, let me tell you that you got fan mail. You know that we send out an e-blast every week explaining what the show will be. And we did one that said she's back this week. And I don't know if you remember Keith Silver, a man, a very sweet man that you met when you were in Washington. But yes, he was like, welcome back. Welcome back, Maria. So there's your fan mail. So tell us, what have you been doing except laying around in California for the last several months?
So first of all, Michael, thank you for the honor to be able to be a guest on your program, Shadow Politics, and about something that's so very important and really near and dear and a passion of mine, which we'll get into. But I want to offer publicly my condolences on the passing of your brother. I am so terribly sorry for you, your family, and most importantly, his family.
Yeah, and we mentioned it briefly last week. He was a great man who did great things, changed the lives of hundreds of people in Appalachia by, you know, taking this little college and making it increasing the enrollment by 70% and adding over 800,000 square feet to the college and opening a new, improving a remote campus. It really did a lot. And not to mention, he was an Air Force pilot. He flew F-111s. I mean, and was a major who was honorably discharged and was vice president of the largest community college in the world, Community College for the Air Force. So, yes, thank you, Maria. He will be sorely missed by many people. He lived a great life. And all I can tell you is that he passed doing what he loved to do. He wanted to fly from the day he got out of the Air Force. He mentioned it all the time that he wanted to fly, wanted to fly, wanted to fly. And finally he did. He got his you can fly a military plane, but you still have to have a private pilot's license. So he had to go through all this stuff to get a private pilot's license, which he ultimately did. And unfortunately, we don't know what happened yet. The NTSB is investigating, but yeah, it was a tragic accident. And thank you so much for your condolences.
Of course.
And what have you been doing? I mean, you've been doing so much. You've gotten your, you know, I've always admired you for so many things, Maria. But one of them is that you're a lifelong learner. and that you're, you know, you were still going to graduate school, you've gotten your doctorate, you're trying to use your degree, it looks like, to do something good in the world, which is, you know, wonderful, right? Because when we go back to college, when we start college when we're kids, it's all about, you know, getting a job and getting ahead and, you know, but now it's just wonderful to see that you've gotten this degree and you've taken on this responsibility of being the executive director. Is that what you call yourself, of Stop the Cut? You started this nonprofit organization, Stop the Cut, and it's really, really, really important.
Well, thank you for that, Michael. And it's interesting because when I started with you as your co-host on the program was right before I went back to school to get my first master's degree in clinical psychology. And then I got another master's in media psychology. And then I defended my dissertation on December 1st for my PhD in psychology with an emphasis in media. And having been a talk radio host for 30 years now, and then having these degrees in psychology, media psychology is a relatively new field. And people say, well, geez, what is it? And it's, we study technology and its effect on the user, the psychological effect, those little black mirrors that we have either from a iPhone or an Android or to a tablet or a laptop or a desktop or what have you. And how is that affecting us psychologically? And it's kind of scary, and I won't go into the details of that, but because eradicating female genital mutilation has been a lifelong passion of mine, which I first learned about 25 years ago, I had a program on National Public Radio, NPR, and my guest at the time, he's a Harvard Law graduate, he went with President Obama to Harvard Law School, and he founded a nonprofit to eradicate male circumcision in Berkeley, California. And I had him on the program because female genital mutilation was in the news at the time. And he was telling me that it's very similar because it's destroying genital integrity and all of that. But that was the first that I dug into it. Now, fast forward, this man, Stephen Savoda is his name, and I are still colleagues. We're still friends. We collaborate. And when I decided to start my nonprofit in California, as you mentioned, it's Stop the Cut, Eradicating Female Genital Mutilation. He was one of the first people I reached out to because, again, we've been collaborating for decades now. And he was like, I wish you wouldn't narrow it just to female, but okay. So in December, he featured me on the cover of their newsletter because he talks to people about eradicating male circumcision. So it's kind of to the choir that I was able to give my message about this is what I'm doing for the female aspect of it. And I was actually flattered that he chose to honor me that way, knowing how strongly he feels about male circumcision. So I don't know about you, Michael, but I did circumcise my three sons, which is one of my greatest regrets. And that's why female genital mutilation exists, mostly because it's culture and tradition. It has nothing to do with religion, which people think it does. And it has nothing to do with anything other than this is the way it's been, and that's why we do it, kind of thinking. And my dad was circumcised. My brothers were circumcised. Their father, my children's father, was circumcised. That's what you did. You circumcised your kids. And then I've discovered later, no, you don't have to do that. And I have two brothers, and one of them had two sons, and he chose not to circumcise his sons. So I've seen it within my own family that these things can stop, and that's what we're hoping to do with female genital mutilation.
Well, I have a question for you, Maria, because I got to tell you, I really don't see. I see the obvious connection between the two, but female genital mutilation is so much more barbaric. It's horrible, and I would argue with you that it's also, besides being cultural, a way to hold down women. I mean, yes. It's a way to subjugate women. And I got to tell you, when you first brought this up to me, and we had, I'm sorry, I can't remember who the guest was. Yes. But we had a woman who was involved in this internationally. I didn't want to do it. It was so awkward for me. I'm the dad of two girls, and, you know, and it was just awkward. I'm an old guy. I didn't want to talk about this on the air. But then you told me what the numbers were, and I couldn't believe it. I could not believe that there are that many women that suffer from this. And I got to tell you, since we've taken this up, and since, you know, I went out on the mall, we did that thing out on the mall and stuff in Washington. Mm-hmm. My wife is a librarian in Fairfax County, Virginia, and she says she knows girls that have been sent back, high immigrant population at her school. Mm-hmm. And she knows girls that have been sent back to whatever their country of origin was. And they've had it done. Now tell me, how, when you say it's a cultural thing, what culture is it?
It's practiced in over 30 countries in the world. And to let our listeners know, female genital mutilation is one of four procedures. They call them stage 1 through 4, where any and all genital skin tissue is cut off. Either the first one is cutting off the clitoris, the second one is cutting off that and labia minora, and then the third one is cutting off that labia minora, labia majora, and sewing them shut. And then the fourth one is pricking, bruising, burning, cutting. And all four are deemed female genital mutilation. And it's interesting because, or they call it FGM for short. It's also known as female genital cutting, and some people prefer using that term because they say it's less pejorative. And I say, bullshit. Let's call it what it's calling. It's not just cutting. You're mutilating. These young girls, and it starts from 6 months to about 15 years of age that girls are cut, and it happens all over the world, and it happens in the United States of America and the United Kingdom and the European Union. It's not an over there problem. But by mutilating, what we say is they can, especially if they go through the third form, they can barely urinate, they can hardly menstruate, don't talk about intercourse. They usually have to go to the hospital from the tearing that occurs. And in childbirth, the mortality rate, it often kills the mother and the child because there's not an opening for the baby to pass through.
Well, and you know what? I mean, we talk about how this happens to women, but really more often it happens to children, right? I mean,
correct. It's almost always children.
It happens to when they're children, and you know, and it's just horrible. And it goes back to what when I look at the problem, it seems to me that it's born in great ignorance. You know, I remember growing up, you know, that I was raised in mostly by two crazy Italian women, my mother and my grandmother. And my grandmother, you know, believed that women should not know anything about sex. You know, and they used to lie to them about things, you know, and because, right, they feared pregnancy so much out of wedlock and things like that. And just that ignorance. You know, this seems to be the most extreme form of that, you know, that they think that somehow they're keeping women pure or something. I don't know.
Well, there is that, because if a female has been cut, it's guaranteed that you're going to be marrying a virgin. And they usually get a higher dowry if they're cut because they're more valuable.
Right.
And so there is an incentive financially for the family to do that. But we should mention that nationally and internationally, it's recognized as a human rights violation. It's child abuse and it's gender-based violence. But interestingly enough, it's the females that perpetuate it. It's the mothers on their daughters.
Of course.
That's what ends up happening psychologically, the trauma that the girls go through. I know a fair amount of survivors, and they say that they would look at their mother who was either sitting on them to hold them down or was in the room watching the aunties hold each limb and the legs apart and thinking, you're the very person that's supposed to protect me. Right. And yet you're subjugating me to this. Mostly, we should also mention that it's done without anesthesia. It's not done in a hospital. It's usually done in the bush. And it's done with rusty razor blades, scissors, or shards of glass. And the girls usually black out from the pain. And when they come to bleeding profusely, of course, some of them die from bleeding to death.
It's so barbaric. It is really, it's so barbaric.
And you know what? But guess what, Michael? People listening might think, oh my God, you know, mostly Americans are pretty ignorant on the subject, which is nobody's fault, which Absolutely. Is part of my mission is to get the word out, because it is an uncomfortable conversation, as you mentioned. But 500,000 females in the United States have been cut, but globally, 200 million women have been cut in the world. Every 10 or 11 seconds, a girl's getting cut somewhere. And by the way, the District of Columbia has the second highest rate of cutting in the United States.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute. There are 10 states
and the District of Columbia, correct,
that don't have a law against this.
Correct.
Now, tomorrow, there's going to be a hearing to pass legislation. I know the people of the District of Columbia, and I know this legislation, you know, I would be shocked to see if this legislation doesn't pass. I'm sure they'll pass it. Had the legislation come about, Maria, did your organization or some other organization propose it? Do you know?
So I don't know the genesis of what the District of Columbia did, other than that Maryland and Virginia do have legislation enacted and against it. And because of that, it's possible that girls were being brought from those states into the District of Columbia, where it's not illegal. So bringing somebody across state lines, there is a federal law in effect that started in 1996, and a Detroit, Michigan judge threw it out in 2017. There were two physicians that were doing it in hospital settings, cutting girls, and he said that the federal law had overstepped the jurisdiction. So the folks that I know here in the United States rewrote the legislation, and Donald Trump, believe it or not, signed it into law. It's the Stop FGM Act of 2020. He signed it into law on January 5th. And of course, we all know what happened the next day. So it never got any notoriety that a federal law was now back in force. But because the states, the 10 states and the District of Columbia don't have it, there's lots of slippery slopes and loopholes that have been able to be utilized in order for it to happen here in the United States. So Kentucky just passed legislation like in the last year. It's still ongoing.
So how do we get around? How do you get around this if there's a federal law? If there's a federal law, why can't you prosecute people under the federal law? I mean, why does D.C., why do these states need to pass this legislation if there's already a federal law prohibiting it?
So because the district and on the district level and the state levels deal with health, child protection, education, social and other services, and first responders and service providers, that's why the states need to do something about it. The feds usually only get involved if you're crossing state lines. So state law fills the gaps left by federal laws. So it's supposed to be like a hand in glove kind of a thing.
Well, it's amazing to me that, you know, that DC made it onto that list of people that have yet dealt with this, because we're such a liberal jurisdiction.
Yes.
We're, you know, it really surprised me. Now, can I guess some of the other states that are on the, what are the other states? Are they Alabama, Mississippi?
You know what? Washington is one. What, the state of Washington is one.
Really, another liberal, pretty liberal state. Yeah.
Yes. Like California has legislation, of course, but there's an organization in the United States that ranks the states by their legislation, outline it, and how strong is it. They gave California a C.
They did?
Yes. So I have a friend who's an assembly member, and I'm trying to work with her on let's tighten this up for the state of California, because the state of California is, you know, just because of our population, we have a large number. But what would shock me is they say that there are 51,000 females who have undergone or are at risk for female genital mutilation in the District of Columbia, second only to New York.
Wow.
Your numbers. And think about your population versus the state of New York.
Right. I mean, yeah, right, right.
I mean, that tells – so the reason also that you had me on the program is because I'm actually testifying tomorrow in front of the Council of the District of Columbia about the legislation, and it's called the Female Genital Mutilation Prohibition Act of 2021. And your legislation, as I've read it, is pretty lock solid.
Oh,
it's pretty damn good. It's like, good. Yeah. Because what you mentioned about Mrs. Brown knowing girls who have been taken, so that's called vacation cutting, and that is illegal federally. If someone knows that they're going to take them out of the United States to specifically have them cut, which has happened a lot, that's against the law. So if people get wind of this before it happens, we're obliged to report it to the authorities, and the authorities then can intervene and block the transporting of the minors. Because keep in mind, it's always minors.
Yeah.
It's minors, yeah. Girls.
It's just crazy. And tell me how my friend Sheila Jackson Lee, isn't she the one that passed the national legislation?
She was,
Texas.
A big proponent of getting it on the books again and getting it to President Trump's desk. It was one of the quickest, they turned it around in about 12 months, getting it from start to finish to the Oval Office. It was pretty admirable what they did.
Well, to me, you know, I mean, it's just a barbaric thing as far as I'm concerned, but it also, to me, just screams of, you know, this is a way to subjugate women. This is a way to, just another way to hold them down. And you know, like I say, it comes out of, you know, I certainly had some experience with an old world. I have to tell you the story, the old world attitude that girls should be ignorant and men should be educated about sex. My grandmother at 80 years old told me the facts of life when I was a teenager. And she did it by telling me a story about a lovely Italian woman who was just the greatest woman you ever met. You know, she made Mother Teresa look like a slacker. But unfortunately, this was a friend of my grandmother's. She couldn't go out in public anymore because of the immense shame that was brought upon her by her grandson, who got a girl pregnant out of wedlock. And so an older cousin was there with me, and she looked at me and she said, "Are you getting this, Michael? Have sex, kill your grandmother. Did you get the message?" And I said, "Yeah, I got the message." You know, and we tell that story because we think it's cute, you know, about my grandmother. But that's the way they believe. They believe that, you know, that you had to do everything you could to hold women down. And you're right. It's women that perpetuate this. When my wife and I get in an argument about my misogynistic tendencies, mm-hmm. as a man, I say, "Don't forget, man, I didn't have a male teacher until I got into high school."
Yeah.
You know, if I'm a misogynist, if they taught me that little girls needed to be treated one way and I needed, it was women that taught me that. It wasn't men.
That's interesting.
And you know, we're always somebody that you admired and I admired, Dick Gregory. The first mm-hmm. time I ever heard him lecture was when I was in college. And that's what he said. He said, it's always about you perpetuating the injustice. They set it up so it works that way. And so I think what you're doing, Maria, is so important, because even though it's uncomfortable to talk about, the only way we're ever going to resolve this is if people stand up together.
Well, so interestingly, when I was doing my dissertation, and I knew that I wanted it to be about female genital mutilation, which, by the way, I got pushback for a couple of years by some of my professors saying, yeah, it's not your problem. You're right. A white Western woman, right, telling other cultures and countries to do something else, and it's largely over there, at, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And I was like, yes, but it's wrong. And they were like, yeah, but who are you? You're not one of them. So fast forward, I got this scholarship about a year into my education, and I used the funds to go to the University of Leeds in the United Kingdom. The collaborator, Harvard Law graduate that I mentioned, he was going to be speaking. It was a two-day symposium. It was called Keeping the EU Intact. And they spoke about male circumcision, and they had one segment on female genital mutilation out of the whole 2 days. And it was this woman from Somalia who, by the way, Somalia has a 98% cut rate.
Wow.
That's their percentage. So she spoke in front of us about her experience. She was 7 when she got cut. She's written a couple of books about it. I'd already read her books. And, of course, you can't help but cry because she remembers it so vividly. And she came to the UK. What is it when you asylum. She came to seek asylum, and which you can do, because if you come from a cut country and you're in peril of being cut, that will take you generally. She had already been cut. But afterwards, I went up and introduced myself to her, and I said, I've been told that, you know, because I present white, that it's none of my business. And she said, I don't care if you're purple. It's child abuse, Maria. Stop it.
Yeah.
You do something about it. And it was her words to me that empowered me to continue on to the dissertation. And that's what I did my research and studying on, was using a theoretical orientation. Do you remember Kitty Genovese, who was stabbed in New York in the early 60s?
No, I don't.
So it was this famous story, because she was this young woman in her early 20s. She came home. She worked in the hospitality industry. She came home. It was after 2 o'clock. She got assaulted, stabbed, robbed. The encounter took about 30 minutes. There were dozens of people that watched it and heard it, and nobody did anything about it. Right. Nobody. This is 1964, New York.
Right.
So these two psychologists decided they better figure out why people get involved and why people don't. So they created something called the bystander intervention model. So I used that theory to see, would it apply to getting people involved in female genital mutilation and the eradication thereof? And I did 2 podcasts, and I solicited people that they were anonymous to me through Amazon Turk. That's how you get people, and they listened to one or the other, and then I tested them with this survey. And what I didn't expect to find, I found, was that just listening to the podcast, not a different podcast, was enough to get people not only to volunteer, but to donate money to eradicating it.
Well, you know, I think that's it, right? It's like exactly the same thing that happened with me when you told me about it for the show. I'm like, oh, come on, Maria. Do we really want to talk about this? I don't want to talk about it. But then when I saw the numbers, and I said to myself, oh, my God, this is hard. How can I not talk about it? How can I not, you know, do something to be involved? I would just feel terrible about myself if I didn't do that, especially as a father of 2 girls, you know, I would just feel awful. So that doesn't surprise me at all. And I remember, you know, from my psychology courses, I guess in college or sociology, the Milgram experiments that were done at UCLA about authoritarianism.
Yes.
Is similar. You know, they hooked a guy up to they thought they were electrocuting him, and some people just did it. They just did it, you know, and only one person ever said, look, I'm not doing this. I'm in the psychology building at UC. I don't need to do this, you know. Nobody else walked out. Lots of them, because they were, you know, they were studying authoritarianism.
To your memory is amazing, but because the person who was giving the participants the directives had on a white coat, there was assumed authority that they were a professional, a medical professional, and that one better pay attention to the you know, go ahead and amp it up. And the just so our listeners know, so this was all staged. It was faked that there was somebody who was allegedly being given electric volts, and they would be screaming on the other end, and the participant could hear the screaming. But what Michael just said is most of the people complied with the orders that were given to them.
Right. And it was a study, because everybody wondered how you got a whole country like Germany, that was a democratic republic, how you got them all to follow that, you know, what they did in the Holocaust, and without question. I think that's a great approach you took. Go ahead.
Thank you. I went through my notes, and you asked about, aside from the District of Columbia, the 10 states are Alaska, Alabama, Hawaii, New Mexico, Nebraska, Montana, the state of Washington, Connecticut, and Maine.
Well, you know what?
They don't have legislation against it.
I would have never guessed Connecticut. I would have never guessed Washington.
Yeah,
there are a lot of states.
And New Mexico is pretty liberal, too.
Yeah. You know, I have family in Alabama, and we keep on saying, God, please let them enter the 19th century down there, you know, because, they're just.
So, Michael, can you tell our listeners what to expect tomorrow? Because I've never done anything like this. I've been given 5 minutes to speak on it, as everyone else has. And obviously, I'm going to talk from my academic perspective and then my, you know, personal passionate perspective. But what is the point?
I don't know how many witnesses there are, but you know, people like you get 5 minutes. Then they would listen to your testimony, and then who's ever on the committee, I don't know that the whole committee will be there, or just some of the committee members will be there, but they'll reserve time to ask you questions, and they'll probably ask you questions about your testimony. And that's pretty much how it goes. And then at the end of the, you know, at the end of all the questioning and testimony, they will vote on whether to pass the legislation or not. Now, when they vote, that's a first vote. There has to be a second vote by the full committee, which will come later. But the second vote, in most cases, is just perfunctory. You know, it's unless there's somebody that would have some kind of serious objection on the committee and wanted to reopen debate, the second vote is usually, you know, more like a rubber stamp. So tomorrow, the legislation may very well pass, but it won't become law until there's a second vote that moves on to the mayor, and the mayor signs it into law. I guarantee you, knowing Muriel Bowser, there will be no problem with her signing this into law. She's very much a feminist, very much cares about women, especially the ones in District Columbia, and she herself has a daughter. So I'm sure that you know, she'll sign it, and I would say this is just going to be it's going to be a good day for you, and it's good, and this legislation will most likely pass.
So how many are on the city council in the District of Columbia?
There are 13 members of the city council. There are 12 council members, and then there's a chairman of the council.
Because this bill is being introduced by 6 members.
Right. So you've got 6 members, probably all of whom I can't remember who the
members. I have all of their names. So Elisa Silverman, Brianne Naidu, Vincent Gray, Mary Che, Christina Henderson, and Brooke Pinto.
Yeah, and I don't think all of them are on that committee, but several of them are on the committee, and then there are several others. I mean, when you have six co-sponsors, you need seven votes to pass the legislation. So you've already got six people.
Right.
So all you need to do is convince one more, and I don't think it's a hard sell.
Does the mayor get to vote?
No, the mayor does not get to vote, but the mayor gets to ultimately sign, just like the chief executive in, you know, like the president signs off on legislation.
Sure.
That's the same power the mayor has locally. She can sign it. Now, if she doesn't sign it, that doesn't mean that the legislation dies. It just means, just like in the federal case, that it goes back to the council for reconsideration, and they can override her veto. She can veto the legislation, basically, but they, again, just like Congress, can override that veto. So that's
because where I live, the mayor is a member of the council.
Yeah, no, that's not the case here.
In the District of Columbia.
No, district.
Okay. No. So you're right. Six is a good start.
It's a great start, you know.
Because they all signed what I have in front of me is the bill with their names on it, that they're the co-sponsors of
it. Well, obviously, all six of them are going to support it. So you only need one other person. And you've got several other women on the council that you didn't name, and I'm sure that they will sign on, people like Anita Bonds. And you know, I'm sure that other people will also sign on. I think this is legislation that may very well pass by unanimous consent. You know, that you may get everybody on the council to support it, all 13 votes. And
which I think this could be a watershed moment for the other 10 states. Then once you do this as the District of Columbia. I mean, they say about California, whatever we do blows east. Well, I would imagine what you do blows west. So,
well, you know, the thing is about the District of Columbia is that you really, when you have things here, you get a national spotlight, you know.
Yes.
Now, the people in Alabama don't give a damn what we do in Washington, D.C., I guarantee you. It's probably, it probably doesn't help you any to have it passed in D.C., but yes, it will get more attention than it would if it passed in Nebraska or you know, one of the other states, I think. And you'll see it. I'm sure the Post will write something about it. And you know, it's important here too, because we have such a large immigrant population.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not sure what, you know, besides Somalia, I bet we have more than our fair share of Somalians in Washington, D.C. We have, you know, we have embassies from almost every country, and we, you know, we certainly have a large immigrant population. That's why Mrs. Brown knows some of these people, because her school has a large immigrant population. It's in the suburbs of Washington. So, yeah, anything you do here. This is one of the reasons our gun laws are always attacked, because if you want to make, you know, if you want to make hay or you want to get some money from the NRA and you're running for Congress in Texas, well, Texas already has very strong gun laws. Mm-hmm. But you come to Washington and they have pro gun laws, I should say. Well, you can come to Washington where we have strong gun laws and attack the gun laws in Washington, D.C. It gets national attention and then the NRA gives you a pat on the back. But, you know, our delegate, Eleanor Holmes Norton, for years spent an inordinate amount of her time just protecting district gun laws until a case came before the Supreme Court. The Heller case came before the Supreme Court, and the court decided that the gun laws in the District of Columbia had to be changed because they were too strict. So they have been changed. But, that's one of the reasons that we get attacked on so many fronts. Well, you know, I'm so glad that you came to talk about this today, Marie, but I can't let you leave without talking about a few other things. So I hope you don't mind. And one of
all
is your expertise on how social media is affecting us politically in America. You know, we see now, I'm just a casual bystander when I look at this stuff, but you know, I don't care what your political position is about anything. It seems to me that you can go on the internet and find somebody that agrees with you.
Correct.
And they don't have to be the least bit authoritative. You know that you can, and I think most people, rather than searching for the truth, actually search for people that agree with them.
Correct.
You know, I don't know what you call that, but for validation of their feelings.
Well, it's a psychological term, and it's called confirmation bias. So you seek that which you know.
Yeah.
And then they don't feel so alone. They also don't feel like they're crazy, like other people might suggest they are, because so-and-so says that, and this group says that, and Facebook here says that. And then suddenly they get emboldened and empowered because, yeah, I knew that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. And they have, you know, I say that about, again, when I think about the prejudice and stuff that existed in my family. In my mother's family, you know, Italian immigrants, they were Italian immigrants. They believed every stereotype about everybody, and they had a story that would prove it, an anecdote, you know, that all the Irish were drunks. And they know that for a fact because my grandmother was on a bus one day and she saw an Irish guy and he was drunk. You know, and that's all the proof she needed. She didn't need to see any statistics. She didn't need to see, you know, as much as the Italians drank wine, you know, it was that sort of thing. So I find that really scary. And now with Ukraine, you know, they're talking about the Soviet Union. I'm so old. They're talking about Russia. Doing cyber attacks in the United States, and not only trying to shut things down, but also trying to pass false information.
Yes.
Now,
as they call it, disinformation.
Disinformation, and I don't know that would have much of an impact in the United States, but it might have an impact in Ukraine, where there is there's always been a tie to Russia. But
but even them saying that Zelensky is a neo-Nazi, who's a Jewish man?
He's Jewish. Yeah.
I mean, it's like, really?
Doesn't matter. Well, you know what? I've had, you know, people believe what they want to believe. I mean, I've gotten in arguments about Donald Trump where I've said, you know, the man not only talked about grabbing women inappropriately, but he did it to a gossip columnist. Mm-hmm. And people say, oh, he never said that. What?
Really?
They have it on tape.
Yeah, I was going to say, we've heard the soundbite.
Right. No, he never said that. Or when he went to the cemetery in Europe, mm-hmm. and called dead veterans suckers and losers. No, he never said that. That was somebody else. He never said that. So, you know, it doesn't even matter sometimes or many times when you put up
the truth.
The truth, yeah. Because there's
the truth shall set you free.
Yeah. I mean, I read in the paper today that a Trump disciple, Governor DeSantis of Florida, mm-hmm. just appeared before CPAC yesterday. And you know that they're very powerful in promoting candidates, and he said, you know, that people need to shield themselves with God against the liberals. Hmm. Now, I'm a Christian. Mm-hmm. I don't get it. I don't. And people believe that. I mean, I don't get that there are people out there that believe that Jesus would have wanted a gun, that Jesus would have spent his time telling you what was wrong with other people. I mean, I just don't get it as a Christian. But they use this kind of rhetoric, and this really fires people up. There's some speculation that he may be trying to go after Trump in the prime. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Well, but I, on that end, I know you were raised Catholic, that the Pope, with his huge sciatica issues, physically got in a car and went to the embassy of Russia out of the Holy See to tell them to please, you've got to reconsider. That's unprecedented, unheard of. And well, that's how deeply he cares.
Well, I got to tell you something. I became an Episcopal years ago. I converted, but I love this Pope. All the popes that it has been my. I like John Paul too, but mm-hmm. but this guy, yeah, this guy takes the cake. I think
he's a Jesuit, right? And so, and they're known for their free thinking and their liberalism and in their academic excellence and all of that, and I'm like, he's just got it all.
Yeah.
He's the one that said homosexuals deserve to be loved too.
Well, like, you know what? You talk about the Jesuits and all that's true. But, you know, Georgetown University, which is a Jesuit university run by the Jesuits for years, they're also just coming to grips right now with things that they did during slavery, which were horrible. So even if you're a liberal, don't think that you're not subjected sometimes to doing cruel and
yeah. And then there's the human condition at the end of the day.
Yeah.
We're filled with flaws.
It really is. And it seems so simple to me, Maria, as a father. Now you're a parent. Mm-hmm. It seems so simple to me. If I had, you know, a very short time left, and I knew it, and you came to me and said, what can I do for you, Michael? What, you know, we've been good friends, and I just want to know, you know, what I can do to help. I would say to you, take care of my children. If my children ever need something that you can give them, please give it to them. If they need encouragement or whatever, keep an eye on my children. And don't you think that's what God says to us? Take care of each other.
Right.
Right? That's what I want. I don't want, you know, I don't care how much money you have or, you know, what other things you do in life. But what I really care about is that you take care of my children.
Well, don't you think that that seems to be what the world is doing with Ukraine against Russia? It feels like we're really getting our act together as a globe.
Yes, and I'm surprised, and I think the Russians are surprised too. And you know that we have to be realistic about Ukraine. There's only so much we can do, right? Because it's inside the Russian sphere of influence. We can't send in American troops in mass and start World War III. So we have to handle the situation delicately. And I think that everybody's doing a pretty good job of it. The world is coming together. NATO, which is often seen as feckless, is actually standing up. And I think that, I think it's a really, really positive thing. And I don't know how much it'll be interesting for people like you to take a look at how much social media will play in all this. But
well, it already is with Zelensky doing his videos from Kyiv, right? Staying put, hunkering down, showing people that, and he's got on a t-shirt and, you know, like a 3-day scruff of a beard and, you know, not the suit and tie that he usually wears. And I think he is charming and endearing and enthralling to everyone. That he's he's not fleeing, he's hunkered down, and it's motivating people, and that's all through social media.
Right, and you know, that's a whole, we're on a whole new great frontier in that regard, that we're bringing the world closer together. You know, it's funny. I read an article not long ago when I was doing some research about my ancestry, but the majority of Americans never knew about the Revolutionary War. They never, it was fought in a couple of states, and most Americans didn't even know that it happened until after it happened. And we're talking about a war that went on for several years. Mm. And you know, then during the Second World War, you know, you fast forward 150 years, my mother, in my attic, I have every front page of the New York Times during the Second World War that my mother kept when my father was in Europe. And that's how you found out about things, right? You found out about the Battle of the Bulge a week after it happened. Right. You know, now we find out about it instantly. Now there would be people at the battle that would be sending you pictures, which you're doing in Ukraine, you know, and we can see the resistance that's going on in Ukraine. You know, they showed pictures this morning of Ukrainian soldiers with automatic weapons standing next to people with shotguns that, you know, citizens who have just come out of their house and said, we're not going to take.
Which is why they're saying Kyiv hasn't fallen yet, that of the organic uprising that has taken them all by surprise. Right. I think it's just brilliant. You know, I wish them well. And here in Southern California, there's all kinds of solidarity with Ukraine. And I don't know what our immigrant population is, or it's just that we got big hearts here. But it's tear inducing as far as I'm concerned. I think it's lovely.
Well, you definitely got big hearts, and there's somebody from California that needs to explain to me why you people have to pay $5 for gasoline.
We're paying $5.30 a gallon.
Yeah, while the rest of us are paying $3.50.
Literally.
You know, it's like we have it out for the people of California for some reason. We don't want to give them water. We want to charge them extra for gas. But yeah, I would say last night that I was very moved at the opening of Saturday Night Live.
Yes.
Did you see that?
Brilliantly. Yes.
Yeah. And for our listeners that didn't see it, they had a Ukrainian choir from New York City, which I assume sang the national anthem. I don't know.
Yeah, they didn't sing.
They sang it in
their language. Traditional garb. Oh.
Yeah. And it was, it was very, very moving. You know, they just sung their hearts out. And I think people in America are moved, and I think people in Europe are moved. And my wife, again, Pat, has been to Lithuania. She has family in Lithuania. Her father has cousins and stuff in Lithuania, and she's been there, and the Lithuanians are scared to death.
And
all the other countries that
once were.
Yeah, you know, it's, I mean, the Hungarians seem to be rolling over, but the rest of them, the Poles and the Lithuanians and other people.
Yeah, they're staying strong, which is great.
Yeah, they're staying strong. And so
I just want to say as an aside that I can't stop my relationship with your District of Columbia and the lifelong learning. Tomorrow I start a new program in diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility. And it's through the National Diversity Collaborative, which is in Washington, D.C., and it's their inaugural program for, you know, DEI&A, and that starts tomorrow. So my learning continues, and my relationship with you in the District of Columbia continues. So,
well, thank God. That means you're going to have to come back and visit, and that means, you know, Mrs. Brown and I are going to have to take you out to dinner and, you know, and get to see you, and we'll be happy to do that.
Yeah, I don't know if I told you, but I got married on Christmas Day.
And, no!
Yes, and my husband has a daughter in Maryland, And I was like, I think looks like we're going to go to DC. I'm going to have to testify. Wow. And he goes, great. And I said, I've got so many people that I want to see. Plus I'll get to meet my, you know, professors and stuff. And he goes, and we'll go see my daughter. I was like, great. So when
Where
they said it's all via
like?
Zoom, outside of Bethesda.
Oh yeah, well, in the neighborhood then.
Yes.
So yeah, so that'd be great. That'd be great, and we'd love to see you. And before I leave, we're out of time here. And let me just say, Maria Sanchez, shadow politics has turned out to be a big deal, and a lot of the credit for that goes to you.
Oh,
so thank you so much for your years of service, and thanks for your continuing service to humanity. This is
Thank
a
you.
Great thing. I Thank plan on testifying tomorrow. I'm going to try to get on the witness list first thing in the morning, and I think they'll probably let me on, and I'm just going to add a few
Thank
words
you.
Because I think we all have to be concerned about this. And so we leave you with a song, as we always do, and this is for Maria and for all the women out there that are fighting for justice for women. Here's a song by Rachel Platten called Fight Song. Thanks. We'll see you next week.
Thank you,
Maria. I'll talk to you tomorrow.
Okay.
All right. Bye.
Like a small boat on the ocean, sending big waves into motion. Like how a single word can make a heart open. I might only have one match, but I can make an explosion.
In the capital of this nation, 100 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.